Hello, and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 26 for November 24th, 2009. My name is Ben Snedkoff, and with me today we've got...
Dominic Rabia.
David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. The first is we've got a first decision in the SciStar case. It's not a final decision, but we'll talk about what the court said and what the implications are for the rest of that litigation. Next, we've got a story about Google Bing and Mark Cuban and whether or not Mark Cuban's trying to ruin Google. And finally, and that was hyperbole, I just want to put a disclaimer out there before you guys get all excited. The last story is about the Google Books settlement and how Google has submitted a revised settlement offer and what that says. So we're going to start right off with the SciStar decision. Now, David, can you tell us a little bit about where this decision falls in the progress of the case?
Well, at this point, I think we have a trial date was set for some time, I want to say in January, but I really don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah, January, early January.
And this is in the California side of the litigation. And so we were really getting down to the sort of the end game in the case as it just comes up to the trial. Both the parties had filed for cross motions on summary judgment. So that means each of them filed a motion for summary judgment. And I think we've probably gone over that enough in the past and what that means. But basically, both the parties are saying there's no disputed issues of fact, and all that's left to decide are issues of law. So they submitted their motions, and each of them thinks that they've got a winning case. And as it turns out, Apple came out on top on this one.
Right. So are they still going to proceed to trial, or did this decision end everything?
I don't know. That's a great question. I would, if I was SciStar, I would probably be thinking about packing it in and just, you know, going home with my tail in between my legs. But
settling?
See what happens.
Yeah.
And there's still a couple issues open, but all of them are pretty favorable to Apple.
Yeah. So the remaining issues in this case are breach of contract, induced breach of contract, trademark infringement, trademark dilution, trade dress infringement, and state unfair competition laws, essentially. And that's about it. And then the issue of damages in all of these claims and in the copyright claims. So there's not a lot left for SciStar to win on, and they lost on all of their major and I'd say most of the important claims in this case. And those were specifically with regard to the copyright claims and whether or not they violated copyright law in the DMCA.
And, of course, the misuse claims, too.
Right, the copyright misuse. So, David, how did the court rule in the copyright misuse issue? You're kind of our resident expert on copyright misuse.
Well, sort of. So this is sort of interesting, too, and I'm going to admit, so in the past I've been talking about how SciStar had asserted this as an actual counterclaim instead of just a defense to misuse. In the order that came out this last week, the judge, the first line in that section on copyright misuse actually says copyright misuse is a defense to a claim of copyright infringement. And that's really interesting because I think I must have either missed some sort of filing that came out or this is the judge sort of taking the motions themselves and making an actual ruling. That's just beyond the pleadings themselves. But if you go back to, I think, the docket filings 51 and 52, that's the order by which SciStar was authorized to make a counterclaim of copyright misuse, and then 52 would be the actual amended counterclaim that SciStar filed. So anyways, beyond that, that's sort of an interesting issue. I don't know what happened with that. Do you guys have any thoughts on that before I go into the other stuff?
No, other than I want to mention that the Second Circuit recently held that copyright misuse is not an affirmative claim that you can bring. You have to bring it as a defense to copyright infringement. So that's more evidence on my side of the argument that copyright misuse is a defense and you can't assert it against somebody without a copyright infringement claim coming your way like SciStar tried to do, even though there was a copyright infringement claim. But yeah, David, you take it away.
Right. So I don't know that I fall on one particular side of that argument, but I do think it's sort of interesting to see how it pans out. Anyway, in terms of the actual substantive arguments that the court addressed in the copyright misuse section of this order, the court basically said that that SciStar had been relying on a couple of key precedents in order to support their side that there was some sort of copyright misuse going on, and the court looked at them a little more carefully probably than SciStar would have wanted, and the court found that they simply would not apply in this case. And more specifically, what the court was saying was that a lot of these precedents really relied on a copyright owner trying to control other people's products rather than use of their own products.
Right. One of the big issues in this case, though, was whether or not the Apple license constituted a mere license, or whether or not when you sold Mac OS X, you actually bought a copy of it and were the owner of that copy. You know, whether you had a license to use it or whether you were the owner of it. What I found interesting about this decision is that, unless I'm wrong, the judge doesn't seem to make a firm ruling one way or the other as to whether or not it was a sale or a license. Did you guys pick up on that too?
I did, and I think it's pretty much because he didn't have to. He just found that the arguments were a little bit without merit, even if you decided the first sale issue one way or another. Because the judge took the position that even if you could say arguendo that there was in fact a transfer of ownership, not just a license at issue, even then a lot of the defenses that SciStar had been asserting wouldn't have applied because the copies that they were dealing with were in fact counterfeit copies to begin with. They weren't true copies that had actually been sold, and copies where there had been an actual transfer of ownership.
Right, because when SciStar would purchase a copy of it, they'd install it on another computer, and then they would make the copies. They'd put copies on the computers that they made from that other copy that was already installed. It's kind of a confusing scheme that they did, but
well, it built off of another argument. It built off. So there was three key rights that were at issue in this. You had the right to reproduction, the right to distribution, and then the right to derivative works. And so the order, which is actually written very coherently, starts off by going through the arguments that have to do with the right to reproduction. And it talks about where the actual copies that SciStar was making existed in some sort of tangible form. And what SciStar had been doing was that they had sort of this separate machine that they were using to image the actual operating, the Mac OS X operating system, and then transfer it over onto third computers. So there were sort of three computers at issue here. You had the one in the middle was the most important, though, and that's where they were making these transitory copies before copying them again to another computer. And there are some other arguments about other copies that also existed, but this is sort of the one that the court focused on here. And while the copies were in transit between the imaging computer and the other computer, that's the key issue of where you had the actual copy that was being made. And so the court also talked about from there how that was impacted by the right to first sale. And what SciStar had alleged is like, well, hey, look, you're right, we're doing this because it's more efficient to transfer the operating system this way, but actually what we're doing is we're including a DVD with each sale of a computer that we're making. So in reality, it's not like we're making illegal copies like that. The court didn't buy it, though, because there was some evidence that was submitted, I think, by Apple's side. They had a computer technician go through about 5 machines, or I think it was 10 machines. And out of those 10 machines, 5 of them, he compared the addition of the OS X software that was on those machines and compared it to the DVD copy of the software that had been included with it. And he found that those two weren't identical. So by that argument completely fails on SciStar's side.
Right. And that leads into the next argument, which is that SciStar created derivative works when it modified a couple of the files so that so that Mac OS X would work with their non-Apple computers.
Right.
Was there anything unusual about that? Because that seemed like a really the judge dealt with it very quickly, essentially saying that, you know, you took the original one, you modified a couple of files, and that's the derivative work, and I'm moving on to the next issue.
No, I think I sort of bought that. He had a nice, succinct way of saying it here. Let's see if I can...
Yeah, I wasn't saying I disagree with it. I was just saying that he dealt with it very, very quickly.
I think he talked about if you, at any time, you're either modifying, deleting files, or making additions to the files of the underlying copyrighted work, you're essentially creating a derivative work. And that struck a bell with me. That seems right on point. And what he was talking about here was the modification and removal of the key kernel extension files, and therefore you have created some form of derivative work. I don't know how you can really get around that, but...
So now that I'm thinking back on this, it worried me because I've modified some of my kernel extensions every now and then. There was, I did one update a few months ago now, and it made a program that I use, it was no longer compatible and it would crash my computer. So I rolled back one of my kernel extensions to what it was before the update, keeping the rest of the operating system the same. So by doing that, did I create a derivative work? And am I now infringing Apple's copyright?
I don't think so, because it was a previous work that already had existed.
You think that the difference... but if
you're rolling back to something that already existed before. That's
not
the
entire
same.
Operating system, though. So if Apple had a discrete copyright on, let's say it was 10.5.3 and a discrete copyright on 10.5.4, and I made a new work that was part of 10.5.3 and part of 10.5.4, it seems like that would be a new derivative work. And that would infringe under this opinion.
My argument against that would be that it's clearly authorized.
Meanwhile, this wasn't authorized?
Absolutely not. They were modifying the files so that you could get the Mac OS X onto a non-Apple-labeled hardware device.
Which is in violation of the EULA. And further, I don't know whether it matters, but they wanted to do this for commercial gain.
Okay. I'm not convinced that it wouldn't be... I mean, I'm convinced that Apple won't come after me for doing that. I'm not convinced that it doesn't make it a derivative work, though.
Well, it might make it a derivative work, but it might fall within the realm of fair use, I guess, somehow.
Well, fair use or authorized derivative works, I mean, I think it's a little bit implicit that if you're... These are Apple releases that you're talking about, correct?
Yes.
I mean, if Apple has released those separate editions of the kernel that you're talking about, and they've also given you the ability to roll back to previous editions, I think right there you have some sort of implicit license to be able to roll back and forth between separate versions of the kernel without having to worry about any serious copyright violation.
Okay. Anything else that people want to bring up? We've still got a couple of minutes.
There was something else in the copyright misuse thing that actually I meant to bring up, but the judge had also talked about how other courts hadn't really addressed the policy problems behind copyright misuse, because the misuse doctrine, as it's stated in the opinion here, states that copyright misuse forbids the use of the copyright to secure an exclusive right or limited monopoly not granted by the Copyright Office, and which is contrary to the public policy to grant. So what they didn't really discuss is the ways in which a license agreement might be contrary to public policy. And this is interesting because every single court up to this point has not wanted to address this. More specifically, you're talking about if there's any way that you could have a fair use claim in order to use some sort of copyrighted work, but you have a license agreement in place which expressly forbids that, you sort of have something that's at odds right there. The Copyright Act itself, the way that it's codified, actually has fair use built into it, and that seems to be at least a component of public policy. And then you have a license agreement that expressly forbids that exercise of rights, which is seen as a limitation on the exclusive rights under the Copyright Act. I don't know how you can not look at that and see that there is some sort of policy problem there and not want to address that in an opinion. Probably this judge just didn't want to handle it at all and is waiting for somebody else to, but maybe at some point we'll have a clearer ruling on what exactly might be contrary to public policy under a copyright misuse defense.
Right. On that note, and this is a slight digression, so I apologize in advance, but I bought a book this weekend, and inside the cover of the book it usually says, "All rights reserved, no part of this book may be reproduced, disseminated, or used in any form or by any means." This book has a "no part of this book may be reproduced," in parentheses, except for the inclusion in reviews. And then it goes on. And I thought that was interesting. It was the first time that I had ever seen a book carve out that exception in the copyright notice.
That's interesting.
Yeah. One other thing that I wanted to mention is that the contributory infringement, which is, let's see, three sentences the court deals with, maybe four. It's
pretty swiftly.
Yeah. One infringes contributorily by intentionally inducing or encouraging direct infringement. And then it says, essentially, SciStar did this, and then moved on to the next issue. I thought that was kind of cursory.
It was pretty straightforward, I think, because Sysar had actually admitted to the reproduction stuff that they had done before. They tried to rely on Section 117, which also assumes that you're the owner of a copy. It's just, the court basically said, well, you've admitted that you are in fact you're reproducing the copyrighted work. Whatever defense that you tried to assert, against that didn't pan out. So it's pretty straightforward here. You're going to be guilty of contributory infringement as well.
Mm-hmm. Any last thoughts before we move on to the next story, Dominic?
Pretty much all set. Interested to see how the trial's going to, if it happens even in January.
Yeah, we'll definitely cover that regardless of which way it goes. David?
No, not really, except that I think we all kind of saw this coming, or at least knew that it was inevitable at some point.
Okay. The next story is in a blog post this week, Mark Cuban was spitballing, and he was talking about Rupert Murdoch's idea to delist all of his sites from Google and instead set up some sort of exclusive agreement for which he'd get paid to list his sites on Bing. Mark Cuban then goes on, and he's thinking, well, what would it take to destroy Google? And there's a site, Jason Calacanis is one of his sites, Mahalo. Basically, what that site is, it's kind of a... What's the best way to explain it? It's kind of like a search engine.
It's human-powered search, basically.
Yeah, human-powered search. So when they started, they got, I think the top 25,000 searches, and they sat down and they wrote up all of those, and they loaded them onto the site before they even launched. After that, they let people who typed in something, and if they didn't come up with any answer, they'd be, allowed to, write their own, description of whatever that is. He was saying, so what if I pay $1,000 a site for the top 100,000 sites, and I give each of those the $1,000, and I say, I will give you $1,000 if you delist yourself from Google and use Bing exclusively. Would I be able to absolutely destroy Google by doing that? And that raised the interesting question for me, at least, as to whether or not that would constitute a violation of antitrust law. And, is this a combination or a contract in restraint of trade? Do either of you have some thoughts before I go on?
I'll venture forth that saying it is a violation of antitrust law.
Okay, so why is it a violation of antitrust law?
Because it's an agreement in restraint of trade. Especially the fact that you're getting paid to delist from Google, I think, is what makes it suspect. But even if it was voluntary, say a voluntary group of publishers that say that we're going to delist from Google and list exclusively in Bing, it seems like that's a contract in restraint of trade. They're specifically targeting Google in trying to delist from there.
Okay, so I guess my question, kind of challenging you now, is aren't there some rights, though, that you're allowed to exercise? I'm not violating copyright law, I'm not violating antitrust law if I make an agreement with a publisher to publish all of my books through that publisher. That's an exclusive agreement, and that's a very common exclusive agreement.
Right.
So why is this different?
There are some rights. I think this is different because you've got basically sort of a group of people agreeing on a restraint of trade. Like, they're all agreeing on doing this together.
I don't think it's the fact that they're all doing this together that really makes it, unlawful. But what it seems to restrict competition a little bit, and it also seems to restrict consumer choice at the same time. And I think those are the principles that might come in to make this a little bit more unlawful than it might be lawful.
Right. I agree with you guys. I was just playing devil's advocate to move the conversation along. And I agree. This strikes me as similar to boycott cases. Mm-hmm. So while it's perfectly all right for a single person to, say, boycott Target, or a group of people to get together and decide to boycott Target, it wouldn't be all right for a group of corporations to get together and agree to boycott Target. Or there's an actual case with these fact patterns. It was a group of construction companies that banded together and boycotted a specific lumber wholesaler. And it's a contract, it's a combination in restraint of trade. And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure that is facially unconstitutional. I'm sorry, facially violative of antitrust law. At least at the time that case came out, I'm pretty sure the court didn't go further and look to see, you know, the court didn't even balance, you know, the factors as to how big a restraint of trade it was, what effect it would have. The court just said, you cannot do that. Companies cannot get together and decide not to use something, not to patronize a certain retailer or wholesaler. Do other people have thoughts on this?
Well, what we're talking about is the difference between the per se classification of an anti or of a combination or a contract in restraint of trade, and then the rule of reason analysis, which is more typically applied today.
Right.
Did you want to explain that a little further?
Yeah, sure. So the rule of reason analysis, you really the court sits down and they look at all of the factors. They look at how big the market is, what kind of effect this is going to have on the market. They look at you know, who the players are, what other competition there is in the area. The per se analysis, and as Dave mentioned, this is falling further and further out of style. As cases about antitrust law have gone up to the Supreme Court has consistently moved away from this per se analysis of just looking at something and saying, no, you can't do that. So if there is something where that still exists, it would be selling a machine that, you know, just puts salt on your driveway and saying that if you buy this machine, you have to buy our brand of salt for the life of the machine. That if there's anything that would still fall into a per se analysis, it would probably be something like that. It's just a facially bad tying agreement. It's this company that has. Oh no, that probably wouldn't. Now that I think about it, would it, guys? I mean, I think now the court would probably first look at whether or not that company had market power in the salting machine market, and then look to see whether or not they were trying to use that power to exercise some leverage over the rock salt market, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's left as per se analysis nowadays.
Yes, very little, if anything.
I completely. First of all, you love those salt machines. This is like the second time you've brought up the freaking salt machines on the show.
But, it's a good example, and it's an actual case, if I recall.
Yes, it is. But
I mean, because it's a good example because they're two very different things. It's you can't argue that, you know, they're the same market or that it's, you know, they're two very clearly different markets, and it doesn't involve any other rights. In that case, it didn't involve patent rights or copyright rights, which muddies the issue. Anyway, David, you go.
If there was to be a circumstance where a per se analysis still applied, it might be contracts in restraint of trade, because if provided that you had at least the agreement or some sort of form of the agreement where you could figure out what the terms were, just on a quick glance of what the agreement is, you might be able to say that, yeah, this is pretty much in restraint of trade, and we don't even have to go any further than reading what the contract says.
Yeah, that would be something like the Dental Labs case, where there was a certain supplier of, I think it was false teeth, that said they sold directly to Dental Labs and told the labs that they could, if they purchased these replacement false teeth from this company, they weren't allowed to purchase them from any other company.
Right. So, yeah. And that's really what's going on here. I mean, Mark Cuban seems to be suggesting, like, hey, let's get together and let's have an agreement. We'll get it down on paper. You guys delist yourselves from Google, and we're going to pay you to do it, and then, you know, we'll have you included into this search engine, and et cetera, et cetera. So it sounds like what we're really talking about is, you know, contracts and restraint of trade here. And so it might be the case that, based on what he has said here, you have something that's just inherently so anti-competitive. It's restricting the competition. And furthermore, it is really hurting consumer choice. I mean, I hate to say it, but I almost exclusively use Google services these days, whether I'm doing web search or whether I'm doing, you know, I'm getting news feeds through an aggregator or something like that. Or image searches or something. Google's always the first place that I go. If I'm trying to find some sort of website or service and I can't do it through Google, chances are I'm not going to look that much further than Google, just because I haven't done that in the past, and even though that might be bad practice.
Yeah, so, I know personally, you know, I use AltaVista all the time. Is that even still around?
Second, I thought you were serious.
First statement. I use Babelfish a lot, actually, for translation. I still like it as the best translation site.
Yeah.
Well, now that since Yahoo picked it up, that's all I use, too.
Yeah, but AltaVista is still around, although I don't know whether the search itself is.
Okay.
Whatever happened to Lycos, anyway? and excite. Oh, man.
It faded away.
Fond memories. Before we get too far down this rat hole.
Internet memory lane.
Yeah, I guess my last argument for why this may not be a violation of antitrust law is that there are a set of rules that have developed in the internet about the proper way, about what search engines can and can't do. The robots.txt file.
All right.
People respect that, and violation of a robots.txt file can lead to liability for trespass to chattels, depending on how you use it. These carry some weight and some respect in the law. So why isn't changing your robots.txt file a valid exercise of, you know, some sort of possessory interest in your right on the internet?
Why isn't it a valid exercise?
Why isn't a valid I'm sorry. Yeah, that was confusing. I think it was accurate, but it was poorly worded for this audience. Going back to the copyright example, if I can make an exclusive deal about where I sell my books or who publishes my books, why can't I use the right that's been recognized in my robots.txt file and in the sanctity that is my web server? Why can't I use that in combination with other people? Or is it that I can use it, but I can't use it in combination with other people?
Well, I'm actually kind of struggling with this one because I don't know that you have as strong as a right as you think you do in that robots.txt file. I mean, I think that a lot of the case law has said you get the trespass to chattels when you have some sort of degradation of the actual web server and you have to have some sort of damage that's conferred in the amount of a lot of traffic, maybe. I don't know that you get it because, you know, you have a robots.txt file and you're telling all the bots that might come around to scrape whatever information your site, there's the Yahoo slurp spikes or whatever. To tell them not to visit here, I don't know that you can actually stop them that way.
You're going Skypey on us.
Did you get the gist of that, though?
Dominic?
It wasn't particularly gisty. It was very Skypey. I guess the distinction between, if I think I understand your question correctly, is, let me try to rephrase it and see if it's right. So why isn't it just changing your robots.txt file potentially antitrust violative? Like, why not just block Googlebot on robots.txt? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I was trying to shoehorn a right that's been recognized in the court into this. And I agree with David that in the cases where a violation of a robots.txt file has led to award in like a trespass to chattels case, there did have to be some sort of substantial incursion onto the network. It had to, you know, substantially affect your input output. It had to, you know, damage a server or something like that. But I imagine, how much tax does a Google robot, does the Google spider put on a server? Is it substantial or is it an insubstantial load?
And it depends on the power of the server. For a decently powered server, it's insubstantial, but it does put a significant amount of traffic on your site compared to a site. I mean, if you don't have any visitors, you'll have more hits thanks to the Google bot. But it's not anything that would kill any modern web server at all.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, I agree with our analysis here. Essentially, that this would violate antitrust laws. And I guess now I'm officially run out of reasons why you could possibly say that it wouldn't violate antitrust law. Anybody else have any thoughts before we move on to the last story?
Well, if you have a website that's open to the public and anyone can go onto it, I'm having a hard time figuring out a way in which you could restrict a search engine from listing you in the results other than the robots.txt file, but I just don't think that right is as strong as you made it out to be.
You can also manually remove yourself from the search engine by asking them to remove you.
Sure, but is there a legal way that you could prohibit them even if they ignored that and kept listing you on there?
I'm not sure, but for some reason I'm thinking about the cases with some, maybe this is way too off topic, but wasn't there a law firm that was complaining that searching for its name would get the first hit was some guy complaining about its practices or something? Or
yeah, probably. I guess my last argument then, for David, and this kind of ties into what you were talking about, Dominic, is you could make an argument, although it probably wouldn't work, that if you put Google in your robots file to ban them, that when they index your site, they're making a copy of it and violating copyright law. My guess is that would be fair use, and it wouldn't go very far, though.
Yeah, but that's just for indexing, though. I mean, if it was just assume that Google could make it so that your site wasn't actually indexed or cached anywhere, so there's no actual copy of it, they were only listing your site in terms of the URL in a, organic results list.
Right, there'd be no copyright interest in your URL.
Right, there would be a trademark interest, but I mean, I think that is safe enough to be nominative fair use that it probably won't be challenged like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And nominative fair use is when you mention a trademark merely to describe that trademark or to describe the company. A good example is when Verizon is talking about AT&T in there's a Matt Ford ads. It's not trademark infringement for Verizon in their ad to say AT&T because they're actually talking about AT&T. The content of that ads is another story and has been subject of some litigation. And did we talk about that a couple of weeks ago?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I don't think so, but maybe I'm misremembering.
Yeah, well, there's litigation that's going on. It's a topic for another day, though. Any last thoughts before we move on to our last story?
Yes. Mark Cuban, he continuously misuses the word "its." And there are several instances in his post which should have had
it. He doesn't use punctuation.
I know. Well, he does and he doesn't. So, I mean, if you're going to do it one way, use punctuation.
Look at the first thing of his post. I'm taking a flyer. I am with no apostrophe. I mean,
right.
I don't think he cares. So.
Okay, guys. We're moving
on. But it's an important distinction. It's and it's. I mean, they refer to
it. It is. One is possessive and the other is a contraction. And for the record, IT apostrophe S is it is. ITS is possessive.
The easy way to remember it is her and his do not have apostrophe, nor should its.
Oh, that's clever. I always just remembered which one's the contraction and went from there.
You guys are nerds.
Yes, we are.
So our last story is about the Google Book settlement. So there's been a revision to this recently, but the settlement itself is several hundred pages long, so we're not going to go into the details of that. We are going to talk about the big concerns here. And essentially what they are. So the EFF's big concern has been with privacy. David, can you talk a little bit about what their concern is and what their big issue is with privacy and these books?
Actually, I might have to ask Dominic to do that.
Sure. Basically, they're worried that the books you read. So let's take a step back. In the olden days where books actually were made of paper and were held in your hand, no one really knew what you were reading. But with Google Books, Google tracks what you read on its website. And the main privacy concern that people have is that Google hasn't put anything in the Google Books settlement agreement about reader privacy. There's no guarantee that the government won't say to Google, we'd like to know what books Ben has been reading, and Google won't be forced to turn it over. That's troubling to privacy advocates because it seems incredibly invasive if Google Books does continue to have a lot of books on it, and people do read books on Google Books, then that sort of thing could potentially be problematic just in terms of having your privacy violated. Like, you don't want people to know necessarily what books you're reading. So right now the settlement doesn't talk about reader privacy at all, and that's sort of the big thing that they're worried about.
See, this has been their argument, the EFF's argument, for a long time, and I find it absolutely absurd for a couple of reasons. One, Google logs all of your searches, too. I mean, and you can turn that off. You can, flip a switch that says, don't catalog my searches. But really, this is their big argument with it? Because you could just not use Google Books.
They do have a clever tagline, don't let Google close the books on reader privacy. So, and you have to give them that.
I'm not going to give their argument credit for a clever tagline. I think they're way too worried about this because I've used Google Books to search for books to find a quote if I needed a quote, but
Right, and their worry is that that is being logged, and unlike a library, you can't anonymously browse on Google Books. There's no way to say, I want to anonymously browse here. Everything you do is tracked whether you like it or not. If you're going to use Google Books, and the settlement means that you're probably going to have to use Google Books because a lot of authors have their books on Google Books because of the settlement. And that's basically their point. They're saying, look, if we're going to force authors to put their books onto Google Books because of the Google Books settlement, then we should have some privacy concerns that can be addressed by Google so that people don't feel like they're going to have their books up there where readers will be logged and tracked by Google as they read and search and make notes. I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate to some degree in that I agree that if you don't like Google Books, then don't use Google Books. Vote with your feet. If you don't like the privacy concerns of a particular thing, don't use it. It'll lose market power if enough people feel the same way. And the competing services, which will respect privacy, should gain market power if privacy is something that people care about.
Okay, so is there an argument that the reason why we care about this and we don't care about the rest of Google is because there's the anonymous switch on the Google searches? Or is it only the distinction that this deals with, this is a search for books as opposed to a search for the rest of the internet?
I think part of it is the settlement. And part of it, the fact that the settlement is so broad and covers so many publishers and thus so many books. And just, I think the other thing is, with search, I mean, this is basically a new element of Google, and they want to attack it while it's still young, in that Google Books hasn't really taken off massively yet because of this settlement, pretty much. And once it does, they want to have those privacy concerns in there right away because they are worried that the government will force, or a third party will force you to Google to disclose your reading history, and that Google will potentially even disclose what pages you looked at and when you looked at them without your consent.
Okay, I guess that ties in well with my next point, which is that a lot of people have raised the concern that since this is a class action and involves so many books and it involves, you know, the stakes are so high with regard to what Google wants to do with these, the rights that Google is seeking to secure for itself, which at least to the best of my knowledge is at the very least what's called a most favored nation clause. They basically want to say, you know, we're going to do this, and if you guys do decide to let other people index your books and make your books searchable, Google has to get the same terms as either what our current terms are, or if the terms that you're making with, you know, Bing Books, we need to get the same terms that you're getting with them. So whatever the best terms you're offering, we're going to get those terms. To get back to where I was going at the beginning of that transcript, there is a worry that what Google's seeking to do is basically create new legislation through this case, that, you know, they're going to use this settlement to do something through the courts that should be done with Congress. I mean, have you guys seen people
Google
raising those concerns?
Create new legislation? I'm confused.
That the effect of what will happen is there's going to be this settlement.
Effective,
I don't think,
legislation?
Yes. Effectively
not
creates
legislation.
Legislation,
but effectively creates legislation. Okay.
Yeah.
I see your point. Yeah, I'm like, I don't see Congress getting involved in this. All right. I understand that point. And I guess that's sort of part of their argument. They're saying this is going to create the new standard. And if we don't make this standard concern privacy, then we're screwed.
Right. I was talking more about the copyright terms, though, and this the copyright issues, because Google is essentially
turning away from privacy. And
yeah,
more,
moving away from privacy and moving on to the more general concerns raised in this case. It's that Google is seeking, you know, very broad rights when it comes to any book published that somebody hasn't opted out of, or that, you know, isn't already in the public domain. Right.
That they are.
Okay. So I guess getting back to my question, I have seen people raise concerns that, you know, essentially what Google is looking for is an exception to the copyright law, but they're trying to get that exception through a settlement in a class action lawsuit as opposed to going through Congress, which is how you'd typically see an exception to a copyright law being made.
Correct. They're trying to agree with the publishers and saying, all right, we want to use your books on our service. Let's work out a deal so we can make this happen.
Okay. Is that worrisome, and if so, why?
the publishers don't have to agree, but they have agreed, correct? I mean, the settlement did happen.
As more people agree to this, I think it sort of becomes a snowball. It gets the snowball effect. You got a snowball that's going down a mountain and it's turning into a huge snowball at some point where everybody else is doing this and you're going to be, you know, steamrolled if you don't. You're either part of the snowball or you're going to get rolled by it, in other words.
Okay, but that, I guess, misses the point a little bit. Yes, you know, the parties in this case are agreeing to it, but we don't care about the parties in this case. We care about the other, you know, 300 million people in America who aren't a party to this case. And you know, is Google's end run around, you know, if this turns out to be an end run around Congress, that strikes me as worrisome, that, you know, while the court has asked for amicus briefs about the first proposed settlement, the court doesn't have the power to, I mean, they do have to approve whatever settlement this is, but they don't have a power to craft a remedy that the parties don't agree to, while Congress could craft a remedy that the parties don't agree to.
Right. I guess it might be helpful to take a step back and take a look at where the settlement comes from. So basically, the Authors Guild and other publishing groups sued Google saying, look, you've scanned our books, you've made an electronic database of the books, and you're displaying excerpts from our books without our permission. And what this settlement accomplishes is it lets Google display those excerpts and potentially longer portions from the book. As for the runaround that you're talking about, well, it's not really running around Congress in that Congress hasn't done anything about it. Congress is free to step in and say, all right, we are going to set down laws for digital archiving of books and search engines in general, and they would apply to Google as well as any other service like Bing Books, if there even is a Bing Books. So I guess I don't quite follow the runaround argument in that Congress hasn't acted.
Well, I guess maybe the argument is a little bit more abstract and just saying that hopefully Congress would be acting in the best interests of the public at large in addition to the interests of the owners of the work themselves.
Well, that's
but
in
to
a
be a cynic for a moment, you know, that as history has sort of shown us, the people that seem to have the most power to affect copyright legislation seem to be the rights owners themselves, as opposed to the general public. Although, you know, not to, you know, I don't mean to overstate that. There have been a lot of good things that have come out of Congress, especially the Fair Use Doctrine that was finally codified into law in 1976, overhaul of the Copyright Act itself. There have been good things that have come out of it, but you know, I don't know that I think probably what's going on here is maybe Congress just isn't the most efficient body to handle something as large as this right now, and maybe it's just easier to go about it this way. I don't know. I mean, I'm not in a very good vantage point to get a feel for how messy this actually is, but I do know that a lot of people have said this thing is a huge mess. It's evidenced by a 377-page settlement proposal, which is still going through various stages of revision, and nobody's happy still, it seems, or at least there's still points that are left open that people aren't happy about.
Okay. Are there any last thoughts before we close out this, our 26th podcast?
This is 6 months.
Yeah.
Hey, that's right. I will probably have more thoughts on the whole Google book settlement after everything gets approved, and I'll have time to sit down and actually read a finalized copy of the settlement draft.
Yeah.
Technically, it's actually just a half a year. 6 months, I guess, would have been 24. So.
Yeah. Oh, same difference.
Yeah.
Okay. In that case, I would like to thank everybody for listening this week. We'll be back next week as usual. So in the meantime, please visit our website, technicallylegal.org. Email us, podcast@technicallylegal.org, or send us tweets @techlegal on Twitter. So signing off, I am Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.
And have a happy Thanksgiving.